KALW.
Usually Fisherman's Wharf is full of tourists, but that night there was a different kind of liveliness.
The crab season was delayed more than a month this year.
And if it says, you know, one or two entanglements means you close the entire season, then there's no way a person can stay in business.
Then the Caped Crusader will meet the author of the latest book on Batman.
There are so many times in his history where if things had gone a different direction, we'd be talking about him in the past tense.
And you don't have to travel to the North Pole for some holiday cheer. A community in Alameda transforms its block into a winter wonderland.
A lot of people ask us if it's written into like the contract when you buy the house that you have to do this, and no.
I'm Henna Ababa, and this is Cross Currents. For many people in the Bay Area, the holidays aren't complete without a big meal of fresh Dungeness crab. The commercial season was supposed to begin on November 15th, just in time for Thanksgiving. But this year, fishermen had to wait a month to set their traps. Late starts have been more common in recent years, and every day of missed fishing can cost the crab industry thousands of dollars. This year, the delay is because of a big lawsuit and big whales. Crab season opened just a few days ago, and KALW's Angela Johnston was down at the docks as the boats came in. She joins me now in studio to tell us more. Hey, Angela.
Hi.
So tell me about the beginning of the crab season.
Well, so far it's been off to a good start, despite some pretty major challenges to starting in the first place. Mm-hmm. I was on the docks as the boats were coming in on Monday night, and it was really cool to see. Usually Fisherman's Wharf is full of tourists, and you don't kind of go behind that front area. Mm-hmm. But that night, there was a different kind of liveliness.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a Saturday afternoon at Fisherman's Wharf.
Right. I walked out on the pier toward the Golden Gate Bridge and saw tons of white little dots on the bay, and they were actually crab boats coming in to unload their first catch of crab. Mm-hmm. They were literally lining up along the pier like a boat traffic jam, and workers were pulling up buckets overflowing with crab.
Wow. And so did you talk to any fishermen?
Yeah, I was there to meet fisherman John Meller. He texted me when his boat was nearby and told me to show up around 9:45. And I actually met John a few days earlier out by the docks, the day before the season was supposed to start. The boats were ready to go, basically filled to the max with crab traps.
My boat's called the High Hopes, and it's 40 feet long. And I currently have 97 traps aboard, which is about as much as I can put safely on there.
And Hannah, can you picture what a crab trap looks like?
Maybe a net with like teeth at the end that just like close into each other? I don't know.
Sort of. They're big round cylinders with mesh on all sides with little entrances so the crab can get in, but they can't get out.
Uh-huh.
And they have colorful ropes attached to them and bright orange and blue buoys. Mm. And they aren't small. Remember, John had 97 of them. So I wasn't even sure how more than one person could be on board these boats. But all the boats down there at the wharf were like this because fishermen were just so anxious to get out. Mm-hmm. They'd been delayed a month, and each day that they're not fishing is a huge loss of income.
And this isn't the first time the crab season has been pushed back, right?
Yeah, no, it's not. Back in 2015, the fishery was closed for over 5 months because of something called domoic acid. It's a neurotoxin that can travel up the food chain brought on by algal blooms. Mm-hmm. And that year was a disaster for many fishermen. And then the next year, domoic acid prompted more delays. This year, the delay has to do with whale entanglements.
Whale entanglements. Explain.
Whale entanglements and bureaucracy. Mm. So a few years ago, an environmental group sued the Department of Fish and Wildlife. That's the agency that issues crab fishing permits. Mm-hmm. And they sued Fish and Wildlife because whales were getting caught in crab fishing gear, those long ropes attached to the buoys and crab traps.
Right.
Crab traps sit on the ocean floor with lines that reach to the surface.
Okay, and is this a new thing that whales are getting caught in the crab lines?
It's kind of a new thing, actually. Whales typically feed on krill far out in the ocean.
Right.
But recently, they've been coming in closer to shore where crab traps are.
Why? Why are they coming in closer?
Well, it's connected to climate change. And it really started in 2014, the same year as the domoic acid poisoning in crabs. Mm-hmm. Do you remember hearing about the big, warm blob, the ocean blob?
Yeah, it was that big marine heat wave on the West Coast.
Yeah, and so that year the blob changed the food supply of whales migrating north. It started to kill off krill, so the whales came in closer to shore to eat anchovies. Mm. In 2015, there were over 60 confirmed whales caught in different kinds of fishing gear. And even when the ocean cooled and the blob didn't return, the whales kept swimming closer to shore and closer to all the crab gear. Mm-hmm. In 2016, there were 71 whale entanglements, the highest on record caught in fishing lines.
Wow.
And nearly a quarter were from crab gear.
Okay, so the environmentalists sued Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, and the department settled. Part of the agreement said that the season will end earlier and is subject to a later start, like it did this year, mm-hmm. if there are whales in the area, so fishermen can avoid setting their traps when whales come closer to shore to feed. Mm-hmm. And if entanglements continue, that could have major consequences for the industry. Here's fisherman John Meller.
And if it says, you know, one or two entanglements means you close the entire season, then there's no way a person can stay in business. We'd all have to quit fishing.
And he says there's this mathematical probability that with so many lines in the water, if the whale behavior doesn't change, the entanglements will happen. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, he says there's nothing worse than entangling a whale. So when this all started a few years back, Meller joined something called the Whale Entanglement Working Group, a group of scientists and fishermen and policymakers trying to figure out solutions.
And so what are some of these solutions?
Well, one is investing in new technologies like ropeless gear that sits on the bottom of the ocean floor and only allows a line and buoy to come up when you send it some acoustic signal when you're over it. But those
technology.
Right. Those technologies are still in the very early stages and they don't always work. And most importantly, they're really expensive. But John Meller is pretty excited about a program within the working group called RAMP, short for Risk Assessment and Mitigation Program. Mm-hmm. He describes it as sort of like a hotshot fire team, but for the ocean. They're also making a gear retrieval program where fishermen will go out after the season is over and clean up all the lost gear and bring it back to the dock.
And so what if those solutions aren't really changing anything? What then?
Right. It's a possibility that this will only get worse and become the new norm with a changing climate. So Meller and the other fishermen think perhaps the new law and the settlement could be even more flexible to help them stay in business.
Okay. Well, did you ever meet up with Meller at the docks?
Yeah, I found him on his boat waiting in line to unload his crab on the docks to a wholesaler.
Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you. You made it.
Yeah, I made it.
He told me the weather was horrendous out there, but they powered through.
Yeah, we pulled about 190 traps today.
So about 7,000 or so pounds of crab.
Wow.
His crew piled the crabs into metal buckets, clipped a bucket onto a winch, and workers hauled it off the boat. They dumped the crab into big containers filled with water, and then those were whisked away by forklifts.
That's quite a sight.
And Meller told me that after the last crab was off the boat, they would try to catch an hour or two of rest before motoring back out and doing it all over again.
Okay, thanks, Angela.
Thanks.
Angela Johnston is KELW's energy and environment reporter. You can reach her at environment@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We'll turn now from talking about the spiders of the sea to a flying creature of the sky. For 80 years, Batman has captivated the imaginations of kids and adults. The mysterious vigilante who fights deadly villains with an arsenal of gadgets is now a multi-billion-dollar franchise. Writer Andrew Farrago chronicles it all in the book Batman, the definitive history of the Dark Knight in comics, film, and beyond. Andrew is also the curator of San Francisco's Cartoon Art Museum. He spoke with KALW's biggest Batman fan, Janae Darden.
You have really cool jobs. What got you into comics?
You know, I've always been into comics and cartoons. You know, I'm a second generation comic book reader. My mom, actually her brother, used his paper route money to buy Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comics. So she grew up reading those, and I grew up reading those and newspaper comics, and we had Peanuts paperbacks around the house. So things like that.
Did you ever think you would be able to make a living doing this?
Maybe junior high, high school, I thought, like a lot of us, I'm gonna be a professional comic book artist. I'm gonna just draw X-Men and Spider-Man and get big bucks for that, and or invent the next Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, something like that. My interest in comic books never went away, but my path changed a little bit over the years. When I went to college, I majored in studio art. Even at that age, I thought this is what I want to do. I want to make a living in the arts as an artist. After college, I just kind of bounced around. I took a lot of temp jobs, office jobs. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Eventually, I made my way out to San Francisco. I looked on Craigslist for volunteer opportunities, and the first one that caught my eye was Cartoon Art Museum. And I said, this is a place I have to visit. And I went, fell in love with it. I said, I'm home. I'm gonna volunteer for you every weekend. And I did. There was a job opening there, so I got hired. And yeah, I've been there ever since. So almost 20 years now.
And you're now a curator, the curator.
Yes.
I want to talk Batman, one of my favorite superheroes. This book is beautiful. I mean, for anybody that's a Batman fan, it's a beautiful book. I'm actually jealous of you. What was the research like for this book? Because it's 400 pages.
Yeah. I've done a number of other books, and I've written about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Mm-hmm. I've written about Looney Tunes. I've written about Harley Quinn and Peanuts. So for about 7 months or so last year, I just lived Batman. I was reading hundreds, maybe thousands of Batman comic books. I was watching all the cartoons. I was watching, and that's a lot of different series.
That's a lot of different series.
Over the years, I was watching the live-action TV show. I was watching the movies.
You went through 80 years of research. So you interviewed, you know, Catwoman, Julie Newmar. You interviewed Batman, Kevin Conroy. So you have to interview the arch nemesis.
Yeah, so I told my editor, like, I got to talk to the Joker. And obviously, Jack Nicholson's a busy guy, so he hasn't really done, I think even in 1989, he didn't do all that many interviews about mm-hmm. that role. But someone who has played the Joker since 1992, very enthusiastically, is Mark Hamill. He enthusiastically agreed to do the interview. You know, I almost died 10 times during the interview because it was just so awesome being on the phone with Luke Skywalker and talking about comic books and animation. Mm-hmm. And he's just a big fan. He's just a big fanboy.
You learned all kinds of things just flipping through your book. What was the most surprising?
There's a lot of fun, exciting stuff. I think for me, what was most interesting was just how many times the people involved, whether through luck or otherwise, they came to a crossroads. And fortunately for all of us, they made a decision that, you know, kept this character in the spotlight. There's so many points in the character's history where if things had gone a different direction, we'd be talking about Batman in the past tense. From the very beginning, artist Bob Kane and writer Bill Finger, when they co-created the character, initially it was Bob Kane just wanting to cash in. He heard that the creators of Superman were drawing a very healthy paycheck every week, and he wanted a piece of that action. So he said, I'm going to go home this weekend and come up with a character. And he came up with kind of a Superman knockoff character, but fortunately, Bill Finger came in and came up with the costume design. He came up with the character's backstory, all the classic elements that make Batman, Batman. From the very beginning, artist Bob Kane and writer Bill Finger, when they co-created the character, initially it was Bob Kane just wanting to cash in. He heard that the creators of Superman were drawing a very healthy paycheck every week, and he wanted a piece of that action. So he said, I'm going to go home this weekend and come up with the character.
Bill Finger didn't get credit until recently, right? Because
right.
You always saw me watch the movies created by Bob Kane.
Right. Bob Kane was credited as the sole creator of Batman all the way up until about 2014, 2015. Bill Finger actually had a granddaughter, which no one knew about this. No one knew that he had any surviving heirs. They were able to go to DC, go to Warner Brothers, and set things right. So as of about 5 years ago, thanks to these tremendous efforts from people, the official credit is now Batman created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger.
So he never lived to see
to get
the recognition from fans and financially.
He did not.
Why do we still like this character? I mean, the Joker movie made a ton of money. Anything I see Batman, I'm running out to go watch it or buy it. Why do we still like this character after 80 years?
Like I said, there are so many times in his history where if things had gone a different direction, we'd be talking about him in the past tense. So if he hadn't had the TV show in the 60s, when it came along, he would have been this least popular member of the Justice League of America, and he might have eventually faded away. If some of the other attempts to bring him to the movie theaters before Tim Burton got a hold of him and directed that great 1989 movie starring Michael Keaton, if there'd been a comedy version, which there almost was, or they toyed with doing Bill Murray and Eddie Murphy as Batman and Robin.
I can't even imagine that.
And it's hard to see the character going the direction he did if that hadn't happened. If Frank Miller hadn't done his Dark Knight Returns story when he did, right around the time of DC's 50th anniversary, then he might not be the most popular character in comic books like he is today.
That was San Francisco Cartoon Art Museum curator Andrew Farrago speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. Andrew's latest book is Batman, The Definitive History of the Dark Knight. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Tis the season when we see houses bedecked in lights and we hear hecka holiday songs wherever we go. One place where the sights and sounds of the season are concentrated is what's known as Christmas Tree Lane. It's the 3200 block of Thompson Avenue in Alameda, where the neighbors transform their street into a magical holiday experience. The annual tradition began in 1938 and has taken place every year since, except for a brief break during the Second World War. It now attracts people from all over the world who come for an intense dose of cheer.
I'm Mike Martin, and I live on Thompson Avenue in Alameda, California. 1 month a year, Thompson Avenue turns into Christmas Tree Lane, and all the residents on this block just turn the whole street into a big light show. I'd say there's like 10 or 12 people that are kind of the core of the group that really make sure that the different jobs are being handed out.
My name is Sherry Hostetler. I help make sure that people can cross the street safely when they're coming to see Santa. And it's a family affair. Our whole family gets involved in doing this. My son is always the elf. We've been here since he's been three, so he's 14 now, so 11 years. He wasn't the best elf when he was three. He's much better at 14. A lot of people ask us if it's written into like the contract when you buy the house that you have to do this, and no, it's completely voluntary. And it really brings the street together. We're, I think, more of a community because of it.
Well, hello, everyone. I am Kris Kringle, always known as Santa Claus, and I am from the North Pole. And I am here at Christmas Tree Lane, the most merry place in all the world. I am here to see all the boys and girls and hear what they want for Christmas. And I'm going to be here all night.
My name is Amy Fenstermaker. I am 52 years old, and I've lived in this house my whole life. As a little kid, I really felt so lucky to live on the street. Most of the houses had like one strand of lights on the roof line, maybe some cutout characters. It was much more quiet and subdued than it is now. I think social media has really played a big part in that too, just like everything else.
Valerie Robinson. We Googled Christmas lights and the closest to our area. This is our first time here. We all decided to come to Christmas Tree Lane just to check out the lights.
Nairobi Robinson Jr., and I'm 10 years old. This place, so far, is very cool. I like how they did all the details on the lights and how they changed the colors on this house and on the other house, how they did the wrapping.
I started on it about 10 years ago, actually, and my kids and I were just trying to think of something clever to do for Christmas Tree Lane. And so we had a little display that included kind of North Pole things with a tree and like one little elf and what we called Santa's workshop. And so we made this one little conveyor belt at the time that just had toys going around and around on the conveyor belt. And this year I've added now a second conveyor. So now they have these two conveyors together so that it looks like the toy parts become toys with the elf making them into the Wrap-O-Matic, and the Wrap-O-Matic makes a wrapped presents coming out the other side.
So they go under the table and there's another conveyor belt to take the presents.
I see something's going on.
My display is pretty classic. Just some white lights and some kind of basic wooden cutouts that my husband did all the artwork on, but nothing like Steve and Mike. It is a really beautiful thing, and I think it's nice that it brings all the community out and brings them joy. There are some days where I'm like, wow, this is a lot. But overall, I think it's an amazing, amazing thing. And it's free.
What's this? What's this? There's color everywhere. What's this? There's white things in the air. What's this? I can't believe my eyes. I must be dreaming. Wake up, Jack. This isn't fair. What's this? What's this? What's this? There's something very wrong. What's this? There's people singing songs. What's this? The streets are lined with little creatures laughing. Everybody seems so happy. Have I possibly gone daffy? What is this? What's this?
That story was produced by KALW's Sarah Lai Sterlin and Precious Green. The festivities at Christmas Tree Lane continue through Monday. Santa will be on site between 6:30 and 8 p.m. every evening. For more information, you can go to kalw.org. And we want to let you know Cross Currents will be on winter break until January 6th. In the meantime, listen to more interviews and stories at kalw.org or binge the Cross Currents podcast on your podcast player. The Cross Currents team includes Imran Ali Mullick, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, True Quinn, and Joshua Sirotiak. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.